It's deja vu. This moment's happened before.
You have found the Kaleidoscope Gallery.
Hello and welcome to this episode of the Kaleidoscope Gallery. I'm your host, Paul Edwards, and alongside contributors Dave, Autumn, Leah, and Hans, we will be exploring the billionaire space race and space tourism, misadventures in Silicon Valley, and the futurist's future, predictions of the future. So let's step into the first exhibit inside the Kaleidoscope Gallery.
Kids down there, I was once a child with a dream, looking up to the stars. Now I'm an adult in a spaceship with lots of other wonderful adults looking down to our beautiful, beautiful Earth. To the next generation of dreamers, if we can do this, just imagine what you can do.
Woo!
Oh my gosh.
In that clip we just heard, billionaire adventurer Richard Branson fulfills a childhood dream, and along with his fellow crew members, celebrate their first flight into near space and the experience of weightlessness on the Virgin Galactic rocket plane. And recently, the U.S. Federal Aviation Administration gave formal permission to Virgin Galactic to start offering civilian passenger service to near space. So if you can afford the cost of the ticket, you too could experience the edge of space and gaze down at the Earth in near zero G. Or you could also line up for a spot as a passenger on Jeff Bezos' Blue Origin rocket, where for 10 intense minutes, you can zoom up to the edge of space, float weightlessly in a windowed capsule, and then slowly parachute back to Earth. And then there is also the proposed space hotels that, according to those behind the Voyager Space Station Hotel, could be ready for occupation as early as an ambitious 2027. The space hotel, with its simulated gravity, would have 24 habitation modules, including a restaurant, meeting rooms, and an event center. The company's slogan is luxury vacations that are literally out of this world. Does this billionaire space race for space tourism and beyond signify a new space age when perhaps soon many people will be able to afford space flights and also further propel humanity's exploration of space? Or is it, as some say, a waste of resources and nothing more than a plaything? A joyride for the ultra-rich. Joining us to explore this exhibit are Kaleidoscope Gallery contributors Dave, Autumn, and Leo. Have you seen what's going on in quote-unquote space tourism rate lately?
I do follow the billionaires race, and I've been following for years what they've been planning with like space elevators and like shooting between New York and Sydney in 20 minutes, and that whole idea of just touching the outer sphere, like it's, you know, just teasing it, and you go, oh yeah, I'm weightless for 3 seconds, and I'm like, oh, that's all crashed back to the Earth. That's not really space, right? It's like fake space. It's like inner space, or it's like the edge of space.
Knocking on space's door.
Yes. It's a tease of space. It's like a good view of the Earth, which I'm sure is mind-blowing.
I know, weightlessness.
Weightlessness, which I, you know, I shouldn't knock it. I would love to do that.
Yeah, I mean, Jeff Bezos is, I think it's called Blue Origin.
Yeah.
And it's like a on top of a rocket, it's a capsule. And it looks really comfortable, actually. There's like seats for, I think, six people. And each person gets a window. And the whole capsule is fairly spacious. And so that when you go weightless, you can kind of like bounce around. It's got like a padded ceiling.
Really? And does everybody wear a padded suit to keep their social distance too? Like, what happens if you like get right up in someone's face? And do you really want to be floating around with a bunch of randos? Like, you might get strange.
5, 4, command engine start. 2, 1. We have lift off. The Shepherd's cleared the tower.
And New Shepherd has cleared the tower on our way to space with our first human crew. Go, Jeff, go, Mark, go, Molly, go, Oliver. You are going to space.
To space. And beyond.
Is it everything you thought
fantastic.
It would be? Dude, look.
This is a case of just like, you and I, yourself, you want to go and buy a ticket to, do they have any prerequisites for getting on the rocket?
I wonder, like, do you have to like pass a couple of tests or go through a gauntlet, run the gauntlet of physical and mental endurance? They lock you in a little room. I doubt it. They're spending a lot of money. They just want to get on the fucking ship, go into space, have a cocktail, float around a little bit, and then hope that the parachute holds on the way down.
As far as I understand, this kind of space tourism, A, it's only going to be for the very, very wealthy, and B, it's not really space tourism, really. It's kind of a thrill ride. Because you're only in space for like a minute or two. Granted, that would be an amazing experience.
It's really just the most expensive roller coaster in the world. Well, for now. But I mean, what passengers don't know is that once you get into space with Richard Branson, he's keeping going. You're going like...
He's not coming down.
You're not coming back. He's going out somewhere in the solar system to like chill. And if you ask to go back, he's going to be like, you can walk.
I think it would be absolutely enthralling experience.
I do think it would be really cool.
And weightlessness.
I mean, the people who talk about it say that the real magic is looking back on the Earth and getting that perspective. But I think you can get the same thing from looking at the stars. Same idea, right? Small. Or maybe when you're looking down at it, you realize how big it is.
Yeah, I think what I experienced in space the first time I looked out the window was an indescribable feeling of gratitude for the planet that we've been given. And I think being physically detached from the Earth made me feel deeply interconnected and deeply interdependent with everyone on it. I think I saw the true unity of our planet, the true unity of our species.
Is there a scenario that by trying to get the weightlessness and not falling right away, that they just keep floating upwards? And then what if that were to happen, how would they be rescued? Like, would the space station need to deploy? Would Elon Musk need to send up one of the real spaceships to like go get him?
I heard that Elon Musk wants to buy a ticket on Virgin Galactic, which I thought was weird. I thought he had his own setup, but
Elon Musk wants a ticket on Virgin Galactic?
Yeah, that's what I heard.
Hmm.
Okay, here we go. Jeff Bezos in space. What the 10-minute Blue Origin flight will be like?
10 minutes.
Yeah.
That's $28 million.
10 minutes. At 3 minutes, as you approach space, you will begin to experience zero gravity. You can float around freely. Blue Origin says New Shepard's capsule offers the largest windows in space. About one-third of the capsule is window. Unbuckle and enjoy. is in the Wall Street Journal. At 4 minutes, you'll reach the top of the flight. Enjoy that $28 million view. It won't last long. 5-6 minutes, time to head home. Please return to your seat and be sure to buckle up, as gravity will be returning with a vengeance. Up to 5.5 G's during the descent. Around the force you would feel on the most extreme roller coasters. Wow, and after 9 minutes of free falling for what appears to be for 3 minutes, the parachutes deploy. And that will reduce the speed to just 16 miles an hour. And around 10 to 12 minutes, you will land in the West Texas desert and share a high five with Jeff Bezos.
Is he going to go up every time? He just has a permanent seat there. He keeps his bed there. It's new apartment.
The idea of a hotel in space is not a new one. Humanity, collectively and individually, has long dreamed of leaving our atmosphere, and combining it with one of our favorite activities, vacation, seems like a perfect match. Soon, that dream is set to become a reality. The project set to make this dream come true for a lucky few is the Voyager Space Station Hotel, which is currently in the serious planning stages. Despite a few delays, the hotel is expected to begin construction in 2026 and could be open for business as early as 2027.
Why do astronauts take, I don't know how many years to train to actually go to space? I mean, fucking hell, right? I mean, what? So you're a billionaire and you want to blow your money into space tourism. You have to undergo like what, a six month intensive in a tank? So you could survive? Like, fucking hell, man. Right?
That's another thing, though. It appeals to us to think about a hotel in space.
We could just float
around.
So reality check, because we've checked out and we didn't realize that, oh, right. The astronauts we see at the space station, they don't look that comfortable in that tiny little tube, are they? Like, that's what it's like orbiting in space. You know, you're like, you're in a research station. You're not in like a glorified, you know, intergalactic hotel orbiting the planet.
Just simple things as urinating.
Yeah, exactly, right? Water alone. I mean,
they're drinking the recycled urine.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the only way to do it. I mean, there's no way to like transport or beam up water to the space station.
Amid the celebrations, Bezos is facing backlash, though, for this comment.
I want to thank every Amazon employee and every Amazon customer, because you guys paid for all this.
Bezos sold Amazon stock to fund Blue Origin, but Amazon has been criticized for underpaying workers and fighting against unions.
Yeah, I think it's a huge waste of money. And I think the hubris is crazy, both between, you know, it's obviously a childhood dream they're realizing now that they're billionaires, but also, you know, thanking your employees that you now obviously consciously know it's, you know, that you've ripped off and fought unionization and pay terribly and et cetera, so that you can maximize your profits, and thanking your customers so that they're bankrolling your childhood dream. You know, it's hubris, and it's what you can do when you have that much money. It gets boring buying islands all the time and, you know, private jets. Better to go to space.
What do you think, though, about the concept that this is, you know, meant to inspire humanity to the next level of, you know, space flight?
So the thought of millionaires or billionaires being able to afford going into near space, I don't see how that is inspiring, other than maybe for a handful of wannabe billionaire kids. But but what would be inspiring is if they had developed a technology that was an alternative to plastics that does a lot of the same jobs plastics do that we require, but is somehow sustainable. Or, you know, some kind of clean energy, you know, to fuel these rockets, you know, or something like that, that was actually looked like it could be contributing towards humanity, not just to a few people going into near space because they have a lot of money to pay for it.
Is it just a joyride?
It's what it feels like. It feels like their own personal joyride and satisfaction for achieving a personal goal, combined with then being able to offer the joyride to other people who have $27 million or whatever it costs to go. And it just is a real symbol of our priorities as a species. When we have certain people who have that much wealth and that's how they choose to prioritize using it, and that's what we think is going to inspire, you know, grandchildren and future generations, I think it's a real lack of imagination and a real lack of humanity and collective effort and caring about each other.
This was your dream, but for all those millions of Americans who are watching this, who are saying, this is a joyride, it has nothing to do with me.
Yeah.
What did you experience that matters to all Americans?
We live on this beautiful planet. We need to take all heavy industry, all polluting industry, and move it into space, and keep Earth as this beautiful gem of a planet that it is.
But I just had a thought, like, what if advanced alien civilization did kind of a fiddler devil deal where they picked three targets, Elon, Richard, and Jeff, and said, we're going to give you unlimited money so you guys can make these mega businesses no matter how many times they fail and they suck, and we're just going to make sure they keep going and you get more and more money until you have enough that you can fly into space for a meeting.
And I'd just like to end by saying, welcome to the dawn of a new space age. Thank you.
You are listening to The Kaleidoscope Gallery.
As you descend the escalator into the Loop station, you see the Teslas waiting to whisk you into a tunnel 43 feet below ground. Now, you might think, all right, it's like a subway. But this is more like a highway underground. And because it's Las Vegas, this is also a thrill ride.
Here's how it works. You enter the station and call for a Tesla.
The Teslas will be manned by drivers for now, but plans for autonomous cars are in the works.
The Loop will use all-electric Teslas, including the Model X and Model 3, transporting passengers 40 feet underground at about 30 miles per hour.
If you were to visit the Las Vegas Convention Center, you would be able to experience The Loop, a 3-kilometer or 1.5-mile long set of tunnels linking one end of the sprawling convention center grounds to the other, and constructed by Elon Musk's The Boring Company. Once you enter the underground station, you and three friends step inside a Tesla sedan with a driver who will shuttle you along at a modest 40 kilometers an hour or 30 miles per hour along the colorfully lit, LED light decorated tunnel. But originally, the $55 million project was promised to be so much more. The CGI renderings in the promotional videos showed driverless, autonomous pods seating up to 15 people, traveling down a complex of tunnels at speeds of up to 240 kilometers an hour or 150 miles per hour. And so, the hype grew. So when the Vegas Loop finally did open up 2 years later, many were underwhelmed when they saw human drivers piloting three passengers in Tesla sedans along the loop at low speeds, leading some to dub the result as taxis in a tunnel. Hardly revolutionary. Well, perhaps an excellent example of overpromising and massively under-delivering at least it wasn't an outright fraud. Enter Elizabeth Holmes, CEO and founder of health technology company Theranos. Holmes became a Silicon Valley darling when she introduced an amazing new technology, a very simple miniature blood test that with one drop of blood could diagnose almost any disease. A huge breakthrough that would utterly revolutionize medical technology. But only after raising over $9 billion from investors was it revealed this blood testing tech was a total fraud, and the tech didn't even exist. Holmes and her Theranos team had knowingly falsified test results and secretly used conventional test equipment to create the illusion of a revolutionary new product. So, Theranos went from a Silicon Valley $9 billion valuation unicorn investment to one of the largest investment frauds in history. Silicon Valley is often fertile ground for innovation, but how is it that many of those in Silicon Valley also are susceptible to overhyped, overpromised, and sometimes outright fraudulent ideas? To share thoughts on this exhibit, we are joined inside the Kaleidoscope Gallery by Autumn.
This is also could just be very, like, you know, very micro, microcosmic in a way, in a sense that really, it's like a phenomenon that happens a lot in Silicon Valley and, you know, San Francisco area, whatever, because any great idea is like it becomes a unicorn, and then you can throw money at it or something, right? So
there seems to be like a little bit more of a gullibility factor in Silicon Valley, because I guess
yeah, absolutely, and like reinventing things, like what they're doing is essentially reinventing things to like find a solution to a non-existent problem, right? So finding a solution to a non-existent problem in order to be able to capitalize from it. That's Silicon Valley itself.
Now let's not say, it's true that there's a lot of innovation there as well, but the unicorn thing, yeah. Do you recall the Theranos scandal?
It's perhaps the greatest fraud in the history of the Silicon Valley tech bomb.
Elizabeth Holmes was everything Silicon Valley and the media could hope for. A brilliant young female entrepreneur who dropped out of Stanford at the age of 19 to start a company called Theranos.
This is what happens when you work to change things. And first they think you're crazy, then they fight you, and then all of a sudden you change the world.
Forbes magazine has downgraded the net worth of Elizabeth Holmes from $4.5 billion to nothing.
Yeah, I mean, you can't get away with shit like that, right? Even if you think you're well-funded and you got the ins on whatever and you have this connection or whatnot, if the science does not prove itself, you're screwed. how can they possibly have thought that they could get away with it?
Is it delusion, like a kind of almost sociopathic delusion on behalf of the founder of Theranos, which was the multi-billion-dollar fraud about a technology that didn't even remotely exist, the magical unicorn blood testing, was one drop of your blood could diagnose you of any disease. But there was no tech behind it.
Exactly. And there was a lot of coverage in the media about it too. And of course, the science doesn't add up. Then she fires somebody who, like, you know, tries to whistleblow her. It happens all the time in Silicon Valley, right? It just exposes the dangers in, I don't know. In just cowboy investments, like, I don't know, like random investments of things that you think will actually, like, you know, take off. But see, people are so easily bought by these, you know, visionaries, these, you know, this like innovative proposals, these, like, you know, a lot of it is spin. If you really look at what it needs to address and what problem it's trying to solve, it's like really, The proposition could be very attractive, but then, of course, there's always the science that needs to be proven, right? I mean, you know, it's all well and good to think that, oh, yes, I've invented a tricorder, those things that in Star Trek, right? And then, oh, yeah, of course, it worked. It really works. You can give me $2 billion on it. Honestly, it works. Look, my team can even back me up, and even if they can't, I'll just fire them, and I'll just change the story. I mean, it's ridiculous. That's exactly what happened. I invented the tricorder, and believe me, I'm okay. Here's your money.
Yeah, that is as simple as it is, and we're talking big money. I'm sorry, but I've still been laughing at this Vegas loop thing with the amazing lights.
We've invented taxis.
Right. It was originally supposed to be autonomous.
Yes.
Kind of pods in which 10, 15 people could climb into this an autonomously driven super vehicle going at 150 miles an hour through this amazingly dug tunnel by the Boring Company that allegedly was going to be cheaper and faster. Yeah. Well, spoiler alert, it was not cheaper. They did not build it faster. And they did not build these amazing autonomous pods. It ended up being one driver driving three people in a Tesla sedan through a dangerous as hell looking tunnel, but cool lights.
Yeah, it's just a tunnel. It's just a freaking, it's a long culvert, right? That's all it is. It's, oh my God, like, yeah, they invented what? An underground tunnel is what they did. With to drive cars through.
If you, the numbers, they're not going to be able to move enough people in that system for it to qualify as anything close to mass transit. So this is a...
Oh, no, this is not for public transit. This is not. It's like, it's almost specifically made for that complex, right? Because it's really, the grid of that whole area is for those two facilities or whatever that expanse is. But it was sold. Yeah, it was sold. Something real revolutionary. It even made me think of, you know, sci-fi stories like Logan's Run. I don't know if you've ever seen Logan's Run film.
I have.
And it's like, I mean, the animation, as you can tell, is very Thunderbird style, but still, you get the idea of like these, you know, fast-moving tubes, right, that can take you from one spot to another seamlessly. And this is the technology that mimics, that's more close to Logan's Run feel, right, because it actually is a tube that gets propelled through like this.
How much of this is driven by basically science fiction?
Oh, a lot of it is, I'm sure. Yeah.
You were talking earlier about the tricorder, the Theranos blood sample. It's basically a tricorder, and everyone's, yeah, we loved the idea of a tricorder. So here's our money.
There you go.
I love the idea of going from LA to New York in an hour on an amazing Hyperloop, but, you know, here's my money, but it's vaporware. It never arrives.
Mm-hmm. So I think this level of hubris, that's what it is, really. The word is hubris, right? This whole kind of chutzpah that Silicon Valley seems to have. Maybe it's just an ethos that comes largely from Silicon Valley, who knows. But it really is based on this confidence that, oh, We've seen how quickly technology is progressing over the past, what, 10, 5 years, 5, 10 years, 20 years maybe? You know, so surely anything's possible at this point, right? Everybody is a fucking visionary. So, and yeah, okay, sure. Like, yeah, I think that works. You know, we can drum up some amazing marketing and some, you know, for that. And like, you know, put lipstick on a pig, essentially, and just make it work, right? We're lost within hypes and visionaries, right? So it's like, you know, that's the hype cycle. Like, it's a culture where, like, you know, everything is really fast becoming modernized. So people are jumping into conclusions very quickly. And people are readily happy to make a buck out of anything, right? So why not now? Why not, like, you know, yes, capitalize on, yes, this is going to happen. And we're gonna create a perfect business model for you to throw some money at me so I can X, right? Oh, I know, it's going to happen. It will happen. But, you know, and you can taste it. It's almost there. It's not here yet, though. You know, but just give me your money.
You are inside the Kaleidoscope Gallery. The Kaleidoscope Gallery.
What about the city of the day after tomorrow, say the year 2000? I think it will be completely different. In fact, it may not even exist at all. Oh, I'm not thinking of the atom bomb and the next Stone Age. I'm thinking of the incredible breakthrough which has been made possible by developments in communications, particularly the transistor and, above all, the communication satellite. These things will make possible a world in which we can be in instant contact with each other, wherever we may be, where we can contact our friends anywhere on Earth, even if we don't know their actual physical location. It will be possible in that age, perhaps only 50 years from now, for a man to conduct his business from Tahiti or Bali just as well as he could from London.
In the clip we just heard, science fiction author and futurist Arthur C. Clarke, speaking in 1961, accurately predicts and describes what is essentially the internet of today. While predicting the future accurately is often difficult, inventor, author, and futurist Ray Kurzweil, whose predictions revolve around technology like artificial intelligence and its effects on the future of human society, claims that 80% of the predictions he made in the 1990s about the world we live in presently have come true. For example, in his 1990 book, The Age of Spiritual Machines, he predicted the prevalence of high-speed connected mobile devices by the 2010s. And the use of facial and speech recognition technology by 2019, to name a few. But Kurzweil has made predictions for much further in the future. For example, in the same 1990 book, he predicts that by the year 2099, humans and machines will have merged in the physical and mental realms, and that strictly organic humans are in the minority. And he predicts, by 2099, essentially all of our interpersonal interactions take place in virtual reality worlds. Our future will almost certainly be quite different than our present, given the progress of technology that keeps speeding along. So what changes will the future bring within yours and my lifetime? What does our future hold? To reflect on this exhibit, we are joined inside the Kaleidoscope Gallery by Leah, Hans, and Dave.
Do you worry that maybe humans will start to become less like human and more like robot?
Yeah, I certainly have had that worry in my lifetime. I think there are people who actually, you know, want that and have a lot of power in the world and are trying to bring us to that future.
I was bringing up Kurzweil, who is a futurist, but he made a whole bunch of predictions, some of which have come true, but they're mainly technological based. So in 1999, he was saying things like how powerful computers are going to be, and he was basically correct. And
But he also makes it clear and lays out that he believes that, you know, into the future, when he projects out, and I think he talks about different phases of our development.
Yeah.
As we integrate cybernetics, computers, etc., into our organic body. But he projects out many hundreds of years into the future, I forget how many, but where we are cyborgs, and he idealizes that. For him, that is a utopia.
But yeah, it's true. In 1999, in his book, The Age of Spiritual Machines,
yeah.
For example, he predicted in 2009, artificial voices sound fully human.
Sure.
Now, we're in 2021.
And they can barely pronounce stuff. It's pretty funny when my GPS talks to me in different accents, but yeah.
Hi, Leah. I am an artificial voice with a Scottish accent, and I heard you do not believe I am real. Really?
But actually, I will say now, with deep fakes,
yeah,
artificial voices are sounding really quite human.
Yeah.
Hi, Leah. How can I help you? Great. No problem. Your transaction is complete. Have a great day.
He predicted the rise of the neo-Luddite movement.
Mm-hmm.
Which is to say, people who are afraid of technology want to put the kibosh on artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
Another thing that, other things that he predicted in 1999, for around this time, militaries rely heavily on armed, unmanned, airborne devices. He predicted that in 1999.
The Navy will be taking a large step into the future of maritime prowess by testing the newest anti-submarine warfare ship, the Sea Hunter. Sea Hunter will be the first unmanned naval vessel that is designed and sized for theater or global independent deployment. It was commissioned April 7th and will be sent to San Diego for a 2-year open ocean trial period.
Check out what he's predicting for 2099, okay?
Yeah.
Machines have attained equal legal status with human beings. Most conscious beings lack a permanent physical form. The vast majority of the Earth's sentient beings are AI.
Yeah, so how are you defining consciousness?
The human brain has been completely reverse engineered. This is in the year 2099, and all aspects of its functions are understood.
We are so far from that in 2099. We are so far from, like, we're scratching the fucking, like, we're pretty good for kindergarten on the brain, and let alone the larger neurological systems, but.
I love this one. Organic human beings are a small minority of the intelligent life forms on Earth. Even among the remaining Homo sapiens, the use of computerized implants that heavily augment normal abilities is ubiquitous and accepted as normal. The small fraction of humans who opt to remain, quote, natural, exist on a lower and more limited plane of consciousness, and thus find it impossible to fully interact with AIs and highly modified humans. I like this one too. 2099. Most humans that are baby boomers are still alive and well.
Oh yeah, this is their fantasy. So what all of this is driven by the people who want to freeze themselves, the people who want to become computers. What they're not admitting is that they're afraid to die. That's why baby boomers specifically are still alive, because he's one. He's a baby boomer and he doesn't want to die. What he should say is, in 2099, I'm still alive.
Yeah, so the trajectory of this futurist technologist trajectory is basically slowly but surely we change our body to match, that we change our hardware.
To not die.
To not die, okay, that's right. And
not to lose our memories and consciousness or whatever. That's what they're trying to say.
And to be able to interact with machines directly and enter into realities that are virtual.
Which, you know, why is that so much better than interacting with the one here? Have we made it that horrible here that I don't want to, like, go to the forest or see a horizon again? Like, really? Like, I hope not. Because virtual reality technology is, you know, not all that, unless you're playing a video game.
Here's another interesting prediction by Kurzweil about the year 2099. Artwork and music created by machines encompasses areas of the light spectrum and frequencies of sound that normal human beings cannot perceive.
So, is there any living creature, like dogs and stuff, are howling and like what? Like, or is it just...
Other machines can appreciate it.
Right. Okay. Well, that's nice. I don't want to live there and I'm not welcome anyways, so, you know.
So you are a neo-Luddite then?
No, that doesn't make me a neo-Luddite. As I said, technology is a wonderful thing and I'm happy to use it, but I am not interested in becoming disembodied.
You are listening to the Kaleidoscope Gallery.
What do you foresee happening in the future within your lifetime? What do you think the future holds in general?
Experience for anything you want,
any experience is like injected into you.
Wow.
And it'll be accessible and it'll be cheap. That's yeah, any experience you want to have.
So whether it be like an emotional experience or an experience of climbing Mount Everest or floating in space.
Exactly. Yeah, like non-addictive. Like imagine if you wanted to, I don't know, maybe there's someone who wants to have a near-death experience without, you know, without any danger, quote-unquote danger, but it's like, but they want to like achieve the brain synapses of whatever, all that shit, or they want to anything.
But when you say not addictive, don't you think it could be addictive to have access to any sensation instantly without any effort? Do you think that itself is kind of like a, will really trigger your brain's reward systems?
Yeah, but I have faith in humanity that we will make it non-addictive.
All right. Do you think that'll mean that people, like artists, won't have to create music anymore? Because
fuck no. Imagine if you like a person wants like a near. No, art is completely relevant. If they want, imagine how much like emotional experience you can draw from like having a quote unquote near death experience that is non-threatening,
right?
That you could create some fucking amazing art from that. Because all, if we have the memory of a feeling, that's all you need to like put that shit on paper or into a song. It's just, it's an attachment, it's an emotional attachment to something. When we do that, we do that with shit in our lives that we don't even know if we perceived it for an event for what it actually was or was something different, but we can create from it and draw from it. So I think it could be incredible for art, for artists.
You could actually increase your lived experience on anything that you've actually not experienced, but you've simulated the experience. So now you can draw on that as an artist to write about it or to sing about it, whatever.
Yeah. If you feel something, that isn't fake. That's how, what I believe. It's like if you have a crush on someone who doesn't even know you exist, you can write an amazing love song about it. That's real. People can identify with, yeah. That's just creating a narrative with, you know, it's people, you know, it's like fake instruments. It's like nothing is a fake instrument. That's what you said.
Yeah, it's true. Nothing is a fake instrument. So. I see your point. When you're a musician and you're a songwriter and you're writing lyrics, probably, but you were probably writing them just recently. Do you draw on your personal experience exclusively, or do you also use like an imagination of what it would be like?
Oh, imagination. Absolutely. Yeah.
Would you agree with this, that imagination is the simulation of experience?
Yeah.
So when you're basically talking about an imagination machine, something that would fill it, like allow you to essentially imagine, but also experience, or like a simulation of, yeah, experience.
I mean, like watching movies can do that, or like watching, listening to music can do that to you. You know, all that does. But I'm just suggesting that there'll be more potent versions of emotional like simulations, I guess. Because they already exist. Because when you watch a movie and you feel empathy for the protagonist or whatever, and it's like emotionally invoking, it's why people watch films, is to almost like adapt or feel something either that they haven't felt before or something greater than themselves.
Natural human thinking possesses no advantages over computer minds. Machines have attained equal legal status with humans, and humans and machines merge in the physical and mental realms. Cybernetic brain implants enable humans to fuse their minds with AI.
All science is moving in that direction. The idea of brain downloading. Brain downloading.
Oh yeah, uploading it to the cloud.
That's a mistake. But if you can upload your brain to the cloud and then download it back into a fresh body, you got a little slice of eternal life.
Mm-hmm.
It also makes sex changes a lot easier.
Another prediction for 2099, most conscious beings lack a permanent physical form.
That I do not think will come true by 2029. Although, if you look at it from a different angle, you would definitely see the rise of social media and the feeling of connections between humans that takes place on Facebook's definitely the best example, where you feel like you know someone, you stayed in touch with them, but you haven't seen them in decades. So in a way, that is happening, but not on a scale where I would say the majority of human contact is non-physical, but maybe maybe that did happen during COVID. Corvid?
Speaking of immortality, Kurzweil predicts that at 2099, some humans at least as old as the baby boomers are still alive and well.
That I definitely believe. I don't believe the baby boomers are ever going to die. They have the perfect timing to, and now that they've like started and like mess with their genes and they're open to it, they're just going to keep doing that. And some of them will live. But definitely within the next generation, I would say the boomers will live. They won't live forever. Like, let's be realistic. It's still early here. But they will live to like 120. We're going to live to like 175. That's how old we will be. And the morphing of ourself with a machine and the merging of our brain with a database will definitely happen before we turn 175. So it is possible that in season 97 of the Kaleidoscope Gallery, we will be part machine already.
Before we part, I'd like to leave you with a short poem written in 1961 by American poet Robert Frost, which reads, "But outer space, at least thus far, for all the fuss of the populace, stays more popular than populace." I hope you have enjoyed this excursion to the Kaleidoscope Gallery. Until next time, and remember, keep it surreal.
You have been listening to the many colors of the Kaleidoscope Gallery.